Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. My name is Chris and I am joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished up watching the 1965 film The Shop on Main Street, a Czechoslovakian film directed by Jan Kader and Elmar Klos.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're going to talk about genocide for the next 30 to 40 minutes.
Strap in, folks. It was kind of an inevitable thing that we were eventually going to hit some films that dealt with the Holocaust. Like, given the amount of, you know, European filmmaking we get to...
Yeah, as sucky as it is, it inspires pretty brilliant artwork.
Yeah, and this is no exception. This film was fantastic.
Yeah, so, I was not expecting this level of masterpiece.
Yeah. I had an inkling based on the, this being heralded as like one of the pinnacles of the Czech New Wave, and I've kind of started to dabble a little bit into that and kind of to see what that's all about. So I kind of had an inkling this would be something interesting, but plot synopsis?
Yeah.
Me?
I don't want to.
You don't want to? All right. So the film tells the story of this small village in Slovakia, and it takes place in on the eve of 1942, so late 1941, heading into 1942. Hitler has just invaded Czechoslovakia, the German army, and as such, the the Slovak army is now following his orders and his regime. Therefore, Jews are outlawed, and yada yada yada. All of that's happening. And that's where we get introduced to a lowly carpenter by the name of Tony, who is a bit of a drunk and a bit of a kind of, like, not really, he's just lazy and chilled out and doesn't really give a shit about much.
Well, everyone describes him as a fool.
Yeah, he's just like...
And he is rather foolish.
Yeah. And his brother-in-law is the head of the local, I guess SS you'd call them, like the local fascist army his brother-in-law is the head of. And, his brother-in-law gives him the job as he takes over a elderly Jewish lady's shop. And it's his job to, like, run that and kind of make sure everything's in order as she is kind of kicked out, I guess. Mm. And as the film progresses, he slowly starts to... he slowly starts to begin to learn about what the fuck is happening in his country and in his town. And he slowly gains compassion for the Jewish people, and in particular Mrs. Lapp.
Well, he already had that. It's just that he happens to...
He was just oblivious, initially. That was...
He's not a worldly man, so he's not going to be connected to the bigger picture.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of where the arc of his character comes in, going from a guy who was considered a bit of a fool, or a bit of a just like, yeah, he's just Tony, it's whatever, he's the local carpenter, just whatever.
Yeah.
He enjoys a drink, versus a guy who is actively trying to save people's life, woman's life, and prevent what is happening. Like, it's a man that cares.
Mm.
And it's
being... A man of substance.
Yeah. Being, coming face to face with what is happening in his town and to the people that he's known his whole life. It's fairly heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a wonderful, wonderful film.
Well, we're done.
Yeah, so tune in next week for... What's interesting about this one, I thought, was the way that they so brilliantly jumped tone. There were moments in the film that were really fun and funny and energetic, and the way that it was shot kind of lent itself to be a kind of quirky comedy in some instances.
Mm.
But it so beautifully shifted to the dramatic and to the heartfelt that it was such a gradual and easy progression that made sense, and you just went with it, and it kind of really grabs you.
Yeah, you mentioned while we were watching Life is Beautiful.
Mm.
And it does share similarities tonally.
Yes.
To that. You know, it's dealing with, obviously, like, fucked up substance, subject matter.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's allowing itself to be...
playful.
Lighthearted somehow.
Yeah.
And so there's this undercurrent
the whole time. It's trying to find the light inside the darkness, I guess. Yeah.
And it does this wonderful job of having this brutal undercurrent, but on the surface it's kind of bubbly.
Yeah.
And so you're allowed to, it's kind of, the audience is allowed to kind of ebb and flow between the two.
Yeah.
Throughout the film. But what struck me is one of its major strengths was actually the acting.
Yeah, well, I was just about to say, I think what you were saying there is due entirely to the performances of the two leads. I think that's what anchors this thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, really
gets you. Who's the actor that did... Are we going to bother...
I've got names.
The actor that played Tony was fucking remarkable.
Yes, his name is Josef Kroner.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman that played Rosalie Lautman, the old lady, is Ida Kaminska. Yeah, those two.
Yeah, it'd be hard to perform as a woman... to perform as a character that's going to be an old woman that has kind of onset dementia.
Oh, flat out, like, I think, yeah. Like, she's...
But it's hard to know how much... She seems kind of with it sometimes and not with it at all other times.
How much of it is a put-on so that she can get away with existing in the world around her at this point.
Mm.
Like, the fact that no one really gives a shit, no authority figure really cares about her because of the dementia and because she's the little old lady, that she's not a priority. She doesn't matter whether or not that... You never really find out if that is... She's playing up because she knows that or if it is just legit. It's... These interesting levels to the character that it's never explained, it's never touched upon, and it's just like, you can draw that as an audience member if you want. It's really fascinating.
Mm.
But, the performance, Tony, I think, because he is our kind of vessel for the film, and he is the person, I think, that has an arc, albeit one that ends in utter tragedy. But it's his performance on all levels, I think, is one of the best acting performances I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I have to agree.
Like, from the start, as, like, the lazy kind of oaf, moving it to, like, just the progression he has is phenomenal.
Just the scope, the scope of his character, being able to play a drunk, being able to play a fool, being able to play a compassionate individual.
A man with a plan, in points. It's a man, you know, seeking redemption. He goes through everything. It's crazy.
Yeah, let's talk about the first scene that grabbed me, and I think grabbed you as well, is the sequence where Tony is given effectively the deed to the shop on Main Street.
Yeah, when he's having a drunken dinner with his brother-in-law.
And it's just, you know, following him, his brother-in-law, and his wife, and the whole sequence is a kind of a carnival.
Yeah.
Where you have people talking over each other, the editing is all completely seamless. It was like a sequence that goes for fairly long, 15 minutes or something.
Something like that, all in all. But I think the point that way I think both of us really piqued interest was it lingers on this one static low-angle shot where all four people are around the dinner table together, having, like, four conversations at once, yet you are just drawn into Tony. And it's this cacophony of noise and, like, these battlings of egos and personalities and ideals all clashing at once, and he comes out as, like, the figurehead of this, and, like, the most important one, and the one that draws your eyes, the audience. To be able to do that in a scene, both cinematically and with a performance, I think is so commendable. Like, when it's just so much shit is happening. Mm. Like, a good example is it reminds me of, like, the only other time I think that I've seen that comes to mind that works is, like, the dinner table scene in, like, Close Encounters, where, like, there's all this noise and all this shit's happening, and Richard Dreyfuss is just...
Oh, he's just making mashed potato. Yeah.
Yeah, but you're just so fucking focused on like that.
That's a good
comparison. And it's like a cacophony, and it's like this low angle thing, and it's very similar to that.
Every single piece of filming technicality needs to be coming in, slotting in place.
Yes.
Just the right place.
And at the right time, and it just has to culminate in drawing the audience's eye into this one character.
Mm.
And it fucking works in amongst like all this chaos. It's incredible. Yeah. And it kind of... That kind of also works really well to plant the seed that, you know, because as we've been established with Tony at this point, like, this is about 20 minutes into the film, he, you know, we've been introduced to him as the drunk, as the fool, as the kind of lazy carpenter, it's fine, whatever. To be able to see him command a room like that and grab the attention of the guy who's the head of the fascist army, like, it proves that he as a character has redeeming qualities and is able to command people and grab attention and be able to do something.
Well, that sequence in and of itself is kind of a foreshadowing of the character arc itself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It displays him at the beginning being foolish, timid, unspoken, sitting there just drinking away. And then slowly, as the commotion is just building up around him, he's able to kind of overcome...
And step out and exactly. Be a shining light above all that. And then after that's happened, he just drinks himself to oblivion.
Yeah, which we see later on too.
Which also happens at the end of the film. Yeah. So, wow, it's a pretty... I hadn't noticed that was a rad precursor. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose... you could say that. What else? I don't know how to approach this one, because we could go
moment to moment, or like historical, or like significance, or like thematic wise. There's a lot to kind of attack here, I guess.
There is,
and I think we both don't want to not do it justice. I guess it's rough.
Should we go moment to moment for now?
Yeah, there's like maybe two or three other major sequences that I want to touch upon that I think are really important to the character growth of both Lautman and Tony, as well as the overall themes of the film that I kind of want to touch on.
Okay.
So fuck it, I might as well do that now. The dream sequence, mm-hmm. to me, I think, that kind of ushers in like the beginning of the third act, I would say. Is, I think, one of the most beautiful things and brilliantly sets up the message of the film. It's this, it's right before the Jewish population of this town are going to get, you know, exiled out. And Tony is hiding Mrs. Lautman in the store, gets drunk, passes out, and there's this beautiful whitewashed scene of the two of them in their Sunday finest floating. They're on...
Doesn't she... He comes in at night time to make sure that she's going to hide.
Yes, yeah.
And then she, thinking that he's had a fight with his wife, just says, "Why don't you sleep on the counter? Sleep it off."
Yeah.
Everything's going to be fine tomorrow. Because
he comes in because he's drunk.
That's right. So, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on.
And just the way it's cinematically put together is brilliant. It's an oversaturated picture that kind of adds, obviously, to the dreamlike quality. And then what the directors have done is there's no... They're not actually walking. They're on rails. They're like on skateboards or something, like just kind of coasting along and then having full-fledged conversations without moving their mouth. It's
like the movie The Jar.
Yeah, it's just... Oh, God. That is a deep cut reference for maybe 1% of listeners. If we have any crossover with Red Letter Media, best of the worst listeners. Yeah. Oh. Look up The Jar, it's on YouTube, it's pretty great.
Yeah, you'll see the floating running sequences.
Yeah.
Obviously, that film drew inspiration from this one.
Clearly. Yeah. You can see the influences.
Yeah.
But it's what's important, what strikes me about that scene is the conversations they have, and it's the two of them in this dreamland, they are able to communicate properly with each other. I'm not saying, like, you know, they're having a shared dream or anything like that, but it's... Tony's able to express the fears and the emotions and everything that he's going through at the time coherently to Mrs. Lautman, and she's able to actually understand it in that dream state, which I think is really important. And then on top of that as well, she simply explains to him what the cause of all of this is, and it's just fear. It's, like, you know, fear is what starts this all, and fear is what will bring an end, like, you know, brings an end to this. Which is what ends up happening to Tony at the end of the film. It's like this wonderful kind of setup and explanation.
So is that the... You mentioned that there was the Czechoslovakian New Wave. Was that... Did you say New Wave before?
Yeah, Czechoslovakian... Czech New Wave.
Czech New Wave.
Yeah.
And so that dream sequence is...
Is like a nice example of that. Yes, like that. Yeah. Yeah, the Czech New Wave kind of started with... God, I don't know enough about it yet to try and pretend to speak knowledgeably on it. But, I mean, we've got a couple of early Miloš Forman films we're going to do. There's a really, like, I mean, I've watched the Miloš Forman films in the collection as well as watched this really fucking trippy movie called Daisies that anyone that's a Criterion fan online seems to absolutely love and adore, and it's really fucking nutty and interesting and visually driven story, but and it's like primarily dream sequence based, which is kind of what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, like, putting all of that aspect aside, I think that's the dream sequence is like one of the most important because of what I was saying. It was solidifying the relationship that these two characters had, as well as setting up the foreshadow and the thematic ending of, like, this is all fear. Like, what is going to be the downfall is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until the end of the film when Tony allows himself to be scared of what will happen to him if he's found out that it all comes crashing down.
Yes.
Yes. that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to... I mean, as with all dream sequences in movies, pretty much, they're all... really fucking hard to pin down.
Yeah.
But that's fine. I think you did a pretty good job.
Mm.
And I'm going to go with your explanation.
Thanks, man.
I have nothing more to add to that.
That's all right. Well, I mean, where do you want to go from here then, I guess? Do we want to...
Let's talk about... Well, I got stuff to talk about for the ending, but then... I don't talk about the ending yet.
Yeah.
I think go into... You kind of touched on the cinematography with the whole, you know, new wave stuff.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned it at the beginning as well, that predominantly at the beginning of the film as well, it's kind of shot like how you would see a comedy shot.
How so?
Just the angles and the framing and stuff. Like, even you mentioned, like, in the early... Like, in the first 5 minutes, you said the framing is kind of often weird in this film.
Kind of, clipped.
Yeah,
It was like the composition, like the cinematographer had a composition, and then they just clipped the sides and the tops, so that it was kind of
just make it simple.
It was kind of squashed or something.
Yeah, it wasn't trying to do anything grand or say anything with the cinematography. It was just presenting and like this simple thing, but doing it slightly off or askew, which made it kind of add to the slant of.
It made it feel like a much older film.
Yes.
Because it's a 60s film.
65, yeah.
And it was shots like that. By the way, those kinds of shots diminished later on, and it felt like a much more contemporary film.
That's what I mean, when it has the slow progression to the dramatic of where we're going to go with the story. The camera work starts to dictate where we're going with that, and kind of it becomes more important and more dramatic as the film does.
Mm.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was meaning. Like, it's more simple and base... to begin with.
Okay.
Versus, like, you know, the flashy and the kind of dramatic styles.
Yeah, which I was not prepared for.
Yes. I don't think either of us were prepared for where this film took us.
Yeah, no. I know.
But, interestingly as well, like, even when the cinematography, like, staying on that kind of topic for a little bit, even when it moves into the dramatic area, when you think, like, Holocaust, World War II, dramatic aspects... You think a lot of, like, harsh lighting, dark shadows, a lot of... There's one scene that takes place at night, even, in this film. Like, it's a very bright film. And I think that's... I don't know, what do you reckon?
Yeah, but it's not... It's not... I mean, it's the beginnings of, you know...
Yeah,
the Holocaust,
yeah.
So...
It's not like
if you're approaching a story that's going to be a person dealing with the onset of it, then why would you? I mean, there's not going to be any POW camp scenes.
No,
yet.
No, I mean, and the worst we get here is the scene of them all being marched away,
taken away, and that's the climax of the film itself. So
yeah,
I mean, there's no reason to do that at night time.
And do you think it's also mainly like, would it be in part because the focus is, I guess, like. Yes, we have this grand, this bigger thing is happening, you know, World War II and, you know, the Germans and the mass, like, attempted extinction of a group of people. But we're just focusing on one man and one simple story and how, like, these two people. And so, therefore, we don't need to kind of be more stylized, I guess, with our... I know what I'm trying.
Well,
I'm trying to work out. Like,
but you're like, we need. If you're going to have a man struggling with the Holocaust, the onset of a Holocaust, do you need the background imagery to reflect that?
Yeah.
But it does, because you have constantly in the background
the building, that the monument. Structure. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's speaking enough.
It's what's happening. Clear an impending thing is coming, because it's with a literal structure being built in the center of the town.
You don't need nighttime shots.
No. I wasn't necessarily meaning nighttime shots, but okay. I was meaning like stylized lighting, like kind of harsh shadows, like that kind of.
But the story is really about the playful nature of people coming together.
Yeah.
Tony and what's her name?
Lautman
is coming together, becoming friends, just because of their wonderful natures that they happen to have.
Yeah.
So I mean, the light moments wouldn't work.
It would be too jarring
if you're going to be doing this high contrast stuff.
Yeah.
So, it works when you're trying to do a lighthearted moment in a Holocaust movie.
Yes.
Rolls the eyes. but speaking of that last sequence...
Yeah.
There's another great sequence where it was Tony drinking heavily, pacing in the shop front, just waiting out. The train
to see seat. If her name will get called, because he's heard, because they're being gathered right in front of the shop and things, and, he's heard one or two instances of, this Jew isn't here, go fucking find them.
Yeah.
Like, round them up, and, he's seen what's happened to, Mr. Catcher, the guy who has been helping him kind of conceal.
The Jew lover.
He is beaten to, nearly to death, and he's, got a fucking board around his neck saying, "I am a Jew lover," and they're gonna hang him and shoot. Oh my god. Why do people do this? But that's obviously his way of dealing with this is to drink himself to oblivion.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. And he just becomes this ticking time bomb that you have to watch through this lengthy.
He even fucking sets it up at the beginning in that opening dinner sequence when he says, "Three drinks makes you sing, five drinks makes you fight," and it's kind of that progression. And it's he gets to the point of he drinks an entire fucking bottle, and that's what brings the fear out in him.
Yeah, you shouldn't drink in those situations because you do bad, stupid things.
Yeah. So,
I don't know, I've never been in that situation.
Yeah.
But you've never
been harboring a fugitive of the state while drinking an entire bottle and pacing?
Can't say that I have.
All right. Well, I mean, you're still young. You've got time.
I'm bound to come up in front of one Holocaust sooner or later.
But sorry, I kind of interrupted and derailed, about that sequence you just wanted to highlight it, was that?
Yeah. This film, for me, is just a moments of wow, this is amazing
and powerful,
and I don't know why it's really
it's
hard
the performance
to, yeah
it is totally the performance
yeah. Well, it's a lot, it's a lot of things. It's the way that
the impact of the subject matter and
the pacing of each sequence has this kind of flow where the tension is allowed to build and build and build.
Yeah,
like that sequence where you're waiting out the names being called.
Yeah.
That situation is so perfect for a character study. Ooh. Watching a single person pace around a room.
Yeah.
Watching them break. There's no one for him to speak to, so you have to just sit there and watch his face.
And the more drunk he gets, the more vocal he gets. He starts yelling to the window.
Yeah, and you're not even allowed to hear what he's saying, because from a point of view of us, the camera's on the other side looking in.
You get the odd instances where, they call, the few times where they're calling the name of a character we've had the opportunity to meet, like Katz, the barber, where, and he's like, "What did he ever do to hit you?" That happens maybe once or twice, and it only really happens with characters that we
have met.
But other than that, we're just given...
For the most part, you're allowed to watch him and through
you're doing
and
it objectively.
Yeah.
Which comes into play, I think, within the final moments of the film, when this entire time the viewer has been passive and objective, and then it becomes really
it's those moments where the audience gets to sit there and think about the situation properly. When there's no one talking, you just watch a person dealing with it.
Yeah.
So that sequence was mind-blowing.
which I think flows brilliantly into the final sequence of the film. We get a moment of... Spoiler alert! Tony, in his drunken stupor, in an attempt to hide Mrs. Lauman, throws her into a cupboard and kills her.
Yeah, and she makes it... The camera cuts before... On the moment...
On the throw.
He throws her, and you hear her scream, and then it's really abruptly... The camera cuts away to another shot, and it's very abruptly cut, her scream, that is.
Yeah.
And then there is the reveal 2 minutes later that she's on the floor dead.
Yeah. Which then leads into a phenomenal sequence where the camera looks directly at Tony. It turns into a POV shot of the audience.
Following him around.
And he makes direct eye contact with you.
Yeah.
And then looks away and leaves frame. And then the camera follows him and finds him again in a different part of the house. He looks at, and makes eye contact. And he has to look away. And it's this amazing transition from previously when the audience was passive. We were outside the building.
Mm.
We couldn't hear what he was yelling. Now we are...
Fucking there.
We are the knowing eye. We are judging this man.
Yeah.
It's fucking insane.
It could be the best example of... fourth wall breaking I've ever seen.
Yeah, because the film is telling you to judge this individual.
Mm.
And he is feeling guilt from you as a viewer knowing what he did. It is so powerful and so brilliantly done.
Yeah, it's amazing. it's genius.
Yes, it really is. And then, leading to his suicide, which... We never actually see the suicide. That, again, flows brilliantly into a finale dream sequence. You know, obviously he has killed himself. But because the torture and the death of Tony was him, us looking at him in those POV shots, and, like, him not being able to make eye contact and having to look away, that was his... We don't need to see the scene of him hanging from the rope. Like, that was enough. Like, that was... So brutal.
Yeah.
And so rough that it was... That's all we need is redemption. Like, redemption for that character. Like, he knows and, you know, yeah, it's...
I like that he decided to let his dog out before he...
Yes.
Killed himself as well, which was nice.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, can you think of any...
Because he's not a bad person. He just... It was fear.
No.
Fear grabbed a hold of him and...
He can't live with himself.
Yes.
Yeah. He's killed the person he's trying to save.
Yeah. Because of the fear grabbed a hold of him and
it's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, can you think of any better use of breaking the fourth wall in a film?
The first thing that popped in my head was a joke answer, and we're having such a serious conversation that I don't want to throw it out.
What is it?
I was just going to say Ferris Bueller.
Oh yeah, that's pretty good. There's also The Meaning of Life, Monty Python's Meaning of Life, the middle of the film.
High Fidelity is pretty... No, there's...
Fight Club's penis at the end of the dick flash.
Oh, Fight Club as well. The Fight Club is full of knowing, like, you know, addressing the audience directly and things. Mm. Like, that's a good example, I think, of subtle breaking of the fourth wall. But nothing is jumping to mind that is a full dramatic extent using... this kind of technique to the extent that this film does it.
Yeah, it's usually for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, yeah, and a joke. It's used for a joke, and it's used to... You know, the term breaking the fourth wall is like, hey, we know we're making a film now.
Mm.
And therefore we are getting a joke by saying, isn't it fun that we're playing make-believe?
Yeah,
whereas
we're getting meta, and meta stuff usually is funny.
Yeah, whereas this is like, you are judging this man. Like, it is brutal.
It is super hard to create a situation where you can use breaking the fourth wall method to deliver a message as opposed to just a shitty joke.
I thought of one where it's a dramatic breaking the fourth wall. The final shot of Kids, Larry Clark's film, where it just fucking ends with the second lead guy after he's, like, had sex with the girl that has AIDS without protection, and just, like, the morning after, just sitting on a couch, looks in the camera, is like, what happened? Like, that is the only other example I can think of, where it's just, like, breaking the fourth wall, simple, and the audience, like, telling the audience something like that.
But never to this effect, like...
No, that, like, even that is fucking powerful in kids, but it doesn't touch what this film does.
Mm.
This film, like, I mean, we've got to do our best and worst next week. I think for that moment alone, this film's probably going to take out my best. Like, this is, like...
Yeah. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see next week about that one.
Yeah.
After we go through them properly. I know what my worst is.
Me too. Jiraiya.
That's right.
I guess, like, was there anything else you really wanted to do with this one? Like, I mean, because I've got a quote from the director that I think kind of summed, like, it's hit what he feels the film is, and its summation that I thought was really nice that I wrote down. But I kind of figured that'd be, like, the nice way to kind of cap the discussion and then move on to trivia and
okay
stuff.
I think we've touched on everything that they
thought
of.
We've hit the, like, main things that I wanted to do, so...
Okay, let's just keep going.
Alright. Well, like, this quote comes from... I lifted this from the essay that comes with the Criterion edition, and it's on the Criterion website. Turns out it was actually from an article written by the director himself from, I think it's the New York Herald from 1966 when the film got its US release. What he says was, "The Shop on Main Street, in short, is an episode of high tragedy, a concentration of the world's absurdity in which good, ignorant, and indecisive people like Tony enable force to get a firm hold and take control." I thought that was a very succinct and wonderful explanation.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
The indecisiveness is the most brutal aspect of any of these Holocaust films.
Yeah, it's the do I do anything or not.
Yeah. The idea that you can't make a decision or you won't. I mean, and it's rooted in fear.
Yeah, which is what makes films like this or like this until we have the tragedy that happens at the end. Or films like Schindler's List, when you have an individual who sees these atrocities and decides to take a stand,
mm-hmm.
however they can, it makes those films impactful and powerful because the Holocaust was such a fucking abomination and a tragedy of mankind that it's seeing that one person is trying to make a difference against this horrible evil is fucking touching, and it gets you as a viewer,
yeah,
and as a human being. So yeah. Yeah, if you haven't seen it, I cannot recommend this film. No.
Well, like, we've spoiled
it.
The ending if you didn't leave this discussion when they said spoiler.
Yeah, but I mean, I've got a little bit of trivia on the movie if you want to hear some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, shit, yeah.
That's what I like to hear. So the film won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film in 1966. It was the submission from from Czechoslovakia and ended up getting selected and winning. Because of its win in 1966, that led to a wide release of the film the following year in 1965 it was released and submitted.
Yeah, I get
following it. 66, yeah.
Yep.
Which led it to be nominated again in 1967 for Best Actress for Ida Kominsky, the woman who played Mrs. Lautman. She earned an Academy Award and a Golden Globe nomination for her acting. As well as Joseph Krona and Ida Kominsky both earned special mention awards at the 1965 Cannes Film Festival for their acting performances, where the film was also nominated for the Palme d'Or. Yeah.
That's great.
Hmm. the only other little bits of info I was able to find were kind of more history-based on this. And it was, the movie was actually shot exclusively in a small Slovak city called Sabinov. And what the directors wanted to do when filming there, they wanted to go for the kind of cinema verite style that was kind of being experimented with. And so all the extras that I kind of had to laugh when you pointed out in the opening scene, like, look at these extras. They were all the townsfolk. They were all, like, the legit people that lived there at that time.
Because some of them felt a little bit unnatural.
Yeah. They had no idea what was going on. And so it was just like, no, we're just going to do a movie in and amongst these people that don't really know what the fuck's happening.
Okay.
Yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool. Like, it's... Fuck it, let's... Like, these people in this new emerging form of cinema with the Czech New Wave being like, no, let's fuck with cinema verite as well. Like, adopt all these different styles and influences and create this thing.
It's wonderful to see such experimentation.
Yeah. But that was about all I had for trivia on this one. So I guess we will move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still in print through Criterion as a one-disc DVD, and unfortunately doesn't really have many special features. All it comes with is a US theatrical trailer and the usual booklet and essays that Criterion do. No kind of in-depth stuff. Yeah.
I would expect that from a film from...
Czechoslovakia.
Yes, that's true.
From 1965. Yeah. Well, I mean, keeping with Czechoslovakia, that'll be our film next week. When we look at a film from the very next year, 1966, with closely watched Trains.
Is it about trains?
No, it is about a guy trying to lose his virginity.
Ah.
While World War II is happening. And he's, like, oblivious. And he's like, I just want to get fucking laid.
Just want to get laid, yeah.
Yeah. It's supposed to be... I did a bit of reading up on it, and it sounds actually really fun.
So I'm kinda... It's like a World War II movie.
It's a World War II sex romp. I say that now, and yet we're going to watch the film next, like, in a fortnight and be, like, horribly depressed again.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard to watch a guy just trying to get laid and failing while World War II is on.
Yeah. In Poland or wherever. Oh, yeah, it's going to be brutal.
Fucking hell.
So, tune in a fortnight for that. Oh, no, it might be. Yeah. Maybe a fortnight, like, depending on schedules and stuff, because... We might slip in a few bonus episodes in before then, because I've got the film festival.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. We should mention before we wrap up that we're recording this on Monday, and on Thursday of this week, the Melbourne International Film Festival, the 65th one actually, is launching, and I'm seeing something ridiculous, like 20 films in 2 weeks there. So, Toby, a good friend of ours who's been on a few episodes, I think the last one was The Blob he was maybe on, he's going to be coming along with me as well, so we thought we'd do a few bonus episodes, kind of letting you know what we're seeing there at the festival, giving some recommendations, because we've seen some weird and wacky stuff from all over the world.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, stay tuned for that. I think we're going to record one on Sunday night, so I'll kind of try and put them out the day after we've recorded them, so they're kind of fresh and new and stuff. So, yeah.
Rad.
But, yeah, stay tuned for our eventual regular episode, Closely Watched Trains, shortly after. But yeah, in addition to that, if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or feel free to follow us on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.